Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Wasn't it wonderful to listen to Janet Frame's poem? And obviously written at this time of the year because she was talking about cherry trees. Kia ora, I'm Jeanette Wallace-Gedge, and it's my pleasure to be with you this morning, or this afternoon rather, and to talk to you about Cobblestones Museum in Greytown and about the history of the wider Wairarapa. It's been a while since I've actually been in the studio on air, and I want to say thank you very much to Marina, who has been coming to my home because I've been kind of incapacitated with my hip. And if anyone has out there listening has had bursitis, you'll know what I mean by incapacitated. It's very annoying. But anyway, here I am, much better. And I've got a fun program for you today. I was just listening to Sunny talk about the Wairarapa from Te Ao Māori perspective. Just fascinating. And actually, you know, when you think about it, it's only about maybe 1,200 years ago that, you know, that's how long ago. And there are lots of myths that have come down and that we listen to in a European fashion, much further away than that. So they're probably really quite fresh. And it was fascinating listening to him as I was driving into the station this morning. Really enjoyed it. So, Sunny, thank you. Absolutely brilliant program. Really, really great. So this morning I've got some books with me. I've got Bagnall's History of the Wairarapa, which I'm holding up now, which I've been very kindly lent to me by Joseph, who is the historian at Cobblestones Museum. And I believe it's out of print now, and it's quite difficult to get hold of a copy, so I managed to beg it off him. And I was reading this week about making out, you know, about how the settlements kind of got going, the European settlements. The best prospects for most of the nominal townspeople were still in agriculture, because unlike the South Island around Dunedin and Central Otago, gold had not been discovered in the Wairarapa. And something of what could be achieved was demonstrated by John Hodge in Morrison's Bush as early as June 1857. Writing not long after he had taken up his 100 acres of bushland, on which he built a five-roomed house, 30 by 16, he said that from one tree I split as much stuff as made the walls of my house and the shingles to cover it. So if you think about that, he built a house that was 30 feet by 16 feet and he made the walls from one tree. The trees must have been huge when you think about the size of that. He had cleared 2 acres and was busy planting wheat and had commenced an orchard. So, of course, land around Greytown in the Wairarapa became famous for orchards. And we still have a couple of lemon trees on our own property. We don't have 100 acres, we have 2.5 acres, which have been there for a long time. And a friend of mine who's a horticulturalist said, goodness me, these lemon trees are very old. So I don't know who planted them. So until he had felled more bush, his small herd of cattle was grazing on Maori land adjoining his holding. His growing family were doing well. So this is John Hodge. And he urged his relatives in England to join him. He said to them, being so far up the country, I don't expect to make much money, but look forward with the hope that I will make a good living. Hodges' concern about wheat was a basic anxiety common to all. How important the crop was at this stage of development is illustrated by press correspondence in January 1860 about an early summer fire which had destroyed crops in Masterton, Carterton and Greytown. Among those who lost part or all of their anticipated harvest were S. Moles, 12 acres of a substantial area, and Hugh O'Connor. One writer, in stressing the seriousness of the loss, claimed that the district had been closer to self-sufficiency at that time than ever before. Early potatoes had been a failure, although despite the fires, most of the small farmers would still have a surplus of wheat and potatoes for sale. O'Connor, in detailing his losses, described his nine chains of dog-leg fence from Manuka and Titoki closely packed to keep out the wild pigs. Gosh. They were hardy, those early European settlers. And really were a hardy lot, and they knew how to enjoy themselves. So a few months ago, I had a visit from a friend who is, he's wonderful. He comes and collects music. And he has managed to collect this lovely music on this CD. And it's the Yester Music of Featherston County Bush, Bog, Brine and Bugle Band. So I thought I'd play a couple of songs from this. So I have one called A Flood Is Coming, which seems awfully appropriate for the next few days, because we've got a bit of a rain warning. I don't know about you, but last night the weather was a bit horrible. So here we go for A Flood Is Coming, an early music. So that was A Flood Is Coming. And that is a revival of yesteryear music of Featherston County. And it's remarkable because it's absolutely delightful. And it was played by a group of people who got together from Featherston, Featherston's finest. And that includes Patrick Bleakley, Matthew H. Dillon, Matt Hancock, Marcus Harvey, Campbell Neal, Sally Marks, Kate Marshall, Paris Mason, Christopher K. Miller, James Neville, Ellen Rhoda, and Marguerite Tate Jameson, and Oreni Tiahi on vocals. Just great music from yesteryear, and that is was given to me by a friend of mine who comes down and collects music. It was just great, just delightful. Well, before we move on to some of the other stories that I've collected, I wanted to tell you a bit more about Cobblestones and about what's happening there at the moment. So in a couple of weeks' time, on the 13th of September, we are breaking the ground on our new building. And that's going to be a vastly extended shed, which will house some of our engines. So these are original sawmill engines and other engines that were used. And our clever engineers, who are supposed to be retired but spend lots of time revitalising things, are hoping to get the Booth sawmill engine going so that we can show people how it worked. And there's a number of carriages that will go into the front part of the, so that we'll be able to tell the story of horse-drawn transport in the Wairarapa. So it really does complement the Fell Engine Museum in Featherston. And if you haven't been to the Fell Engine Museum in Featherston, can I recommend that you go there? Because it's great. And if you ask very nicely, they might let you push the start button on the Fell engine, which is a working engine, and it gets going. So you get a really good idea of how amazing those Fell engines really were. They were specially built to take the train up the Fell, so up and through the tunnel at the top of the Rimutaka range on the way from Wellington to Masterton and then Masterton to Wellington. So they changed engines, and that was the only part of the trip that they did. And it was so steep coming down from the top that they used up an entire set of blocks every time. And they gripped the track to stop the train running away. It's well worth going to see it, I promise you. Really, really good. And as I said, if you're very well behaved, they might let you start the whole thing going. Now, what else to tell you about? Oh, yes, I know what you might enjoy. So, Saturday, the 31st of August, there's a garage sale at Cobblestones, and it starts at 10 o'clock. I've seen some, honestly, there's some great stuff in there. You should go and have a look. And what it is for, it's raising funds, because of course building a new building is not cheap. It's going to be around $500,000 to build this building. We've luckily got some great grants. So thanks to Eastern and Central, thanks to lotteries, grants, we're well on the way. We're almost there with raising enough money. But of course, once we've built the building, we're going to have to fit it out as well. So garage sales are a great way of raising funds, and they're really good fun. Entry through the back gate in East Street. So don't come through the front gate. Entry through the back gate in East Street, and it's I mean, garage sales are always a huge amount of fun, aren't they? So come along and bring cash for the garage sale. It's always a really good, really, really good way of raising funds and having some fun. And there'll be a sausage sizzle for the kids and some games for the kids to play. So just come along and don't come through the front entrance. Then you have to pay and look around the museum. Come through the back entrance. So the back gate will be open on Saturday morning. And a good time will be had by all. What else is happening? Oh, the groundbreaking ceremony on the 13th, if you would like to come along. We will have a little ceremony and a karakia. So every time I come in to the Arrow FM, at the front entrance, I get to pick up a card. And the first one on the top this morning said prayer. And on the other side of the card is the Māori word, because I'm refreshing my memory of Māori language, te reo. And it happened to be karakia. So we will be having a karakia, we hope, on the 13th. And you are very welcome to come along and celebrate with us, because this is probably going to be the last big project at Cobblestones, and it is going to be a big project to build this museum. Okay, should we have another song? On this CD that I had here, it says there's a song called Hey Joseph, otherwise known as the Bushfellas duet. So I thought I might play this one to you. It's called Hey Joseph, J-O-S-E-F. So I think it might be Scandinavian. And it's otherwise known as the Bushfellas duet. So here we go.
Yeah, so sometimes you drop trees in pairs. One fellow would sing the tune and the second would fall in with a swing of his axe. After a verse, they'd swap over, see, and the first would put to the chop whilst the other'd sing in his reprieve. And they'd go on like that till the tree came down. That was a tree felling duet as done by the Scandies and the Wairarapa. Mostly it was in Norse or Danish or what have you, but something like Hey Joseph, yeah, it was in English.
Gone with that axe in your hand. Where you taking that axe, yo? Where you taking that axe, yo? Where you going with that axe in your hand? I'm going chop my old lady, to chop my old lady, chop my old lady, caught her messing round the town. Hey, hey there, I heard you chopped your woman down. Heard you chopped your woman. Heard you chopped your woman. I heard you chopped your woman down. Yes, I did got her. Them both whilst in my bed. Got them both whilst in my bed. Got them both, now they're dead. Got them both right through the head. To White Eddie, old Tom Long ain't gonna hang me.
Wow, that was amazing. That's obviously from the Scandies, the Scandinavians who came here to the Wairarapa. And I pulled up, while that was playing, the a bit about the Scandinavian settlement in the Wairarapa. And in fact, my husband, one of his ancestors was, two of his ancestors were Scandinavian. One was from Sweden, and he actually came from Gotland, which is an island right in the middle of the Baltic. I've been there. It's not a very big island. But goodness me, I've never seen so many churches in my entire life. It was amazing. It was obviously a very Christian place, even though they were Vikings. So they had converted to Christianity. And it had been a Viking stronghold. Which is the excuse that my husband uses when he's been misbehaving. He says it's his Viking ancestors. And his great-great-grandmother was Danish and had come out as a very small child with her parents to Plymouth, to New Plymouth area. So they weren't part of the original Scandinavian settlement, but it's really interesting to read about it because it says, because of delays in purchasing and the allocation of responsibility, the land required for the Scandinavians in the North Wairarapa was not available when the immigrants selected through the staff of the Agent General's London office began to arrive in New Zealand. There were proposals for a settlement also of Canadians and less firmly of Scottish settlers, but in the end it was the Danes, Swedes and Norwegians who formed the first line. The chosen immigrants on embarkation, if unable to pay the fare of £5 in cash, signed a promissory note, as had the Carterton predecessors 15 years earlier, for the sum of £8. The sum was supposed to have been £10, but because one agent made a mistake, the lower fare had to apply to all. And it seems quite a large amount to go up, but anyway. The men undertook to repay the loan by regular deductions from their wages once they were earning. In addition to the location costs, that is the expense incurred in taking them from Wellington to the front, and the value of the tools given to them were added to the required refund. The deductions were at the rate of £1 a month if their total indebtedness was not more than £24, and at 1/24th of the amount owing if more. The settlers did not have to pay anything for the land during the first 2 years of occupation, but in that time were expected to have erected a cottage, felled bush and grassed or put in crops on an area not less than 5 acres. Gosh, that's a lot to, when you think, you know, they were doing this all by hand. The men who fulfilled these conditions would be allowed to purchase their 40-acre sections by 3 equal instalments of £13, 6 shillings and 8 pence. The expectation was that 5 years' hard work and strict economy should not be difficult to the industrious labourer supplied for some time with work for the government, and would make each the owner of a freehold estate of 40 acres. Gosh, that would have seemed such a lot, because we saw the farm that my husband's great-great-grandfather had come from in Gotland. And what had happened was the eldest son had stayed on the farm, and his three brothers had left the farm to go and find their fortune, because the small farm in Gotland certainly wouldn't have supported four families. So the England on which the first batch of Scandinavian settlers came to New Zealand sailed from Norway via London early in November in 1871. The midwinter crossing of the North Sea was a brutal introduction to the trials of the long voyage ahead. As G.C. Peterson, the historian of the Morrisville settlers, writes, "The voyage, which had commenced as so auspiciously, was accompanied throughout by misfortune and tragedy. No precautions to safeguard the health of the passengers had been taken, and the ship's doctor was a callous, drunken, incompetent. An epidemic of measles broke out, and during the voyage, three Scandinavian adults and 11 children died. On arrival, the vessel was quarantined at Soames Island for a fortnight." Soames Island, of course, being in the middle of Wellington Harbour. And that was always the quarantine island. "The advance guard of 19 men, which set out on 8 April 1872, would have found the long walk over the Rumataka Hill, which of course was already familiar to almost two generations of Wairarapa settlers, would have been a wearisome march. The acting immigration agent, E.F. Halcombe, accompanied the party, which was reported to consist of 15 Swedes, and that was the Mercury's generic term for Scandinavians, three Englishmen, one Scotsman, and the interpreter. On the second evening, they reached the Masterton Stockade, briefly useful as an immigration transit camp, and the following morning trudged across the Opaki and the Rumahanga to the site of the camp, on the bush edge not far from the Kopuaranga. Work started immediately on the construction of farries and barracks for their waiting wives and families, and for themselves. The standard issue to each man was an axe, a billhook, a shingle hammer, a spade, and 6 pounds of nails. For common use, there was a crosscut saw, some crowbars, grindstones, and augers, but one wonders how the 7 tin billies and 11 frying pans were divided up. I would say they probably did a lot of cooking in common. The interpreter was E.S. Dreyer, who clearly did not earn the distinction of having the small village which matured from the camp named after him, although the name Dreyerton was changed in 1904 to Kopuaranga. He was a Danish-speaking German who had come to Nelson from Schleswig-Holstein, and in the 1864 struggle with Denmark for the tiny state was reported to have supported the German cause. His lack of sympathy with the Danes and his unjustified denigration of them as filthy by nature did not go unchallenged, particularly when he assumed the role of Henry Bannister's man on the spot in charge of the latter's camp branch of the Masterton store. Much more popular was Alex Munro, the Works Department engineer, who for some 4 years was virtually in charge of the settlement and later of Ekitahuna. The comment, "We beg to state the engineer is a gentleman for whom we all bear a deep respect," shows a degree of regard which was certainly not extended to the interpreter. Gosh, that would have been I know the Danes and the Danes and the Germans didn't always get on, I hear. I thought what I might do now is play a song called The Splitter's Woe, which is written by Adam McGrath. And Adam McGrath describes himself as a minstrel, a travelling minstrel. And he writes very interesting songs, and he has a very interesting way of playing. He's actually playing, I think it's this weekend, I'll check, at the Blues and Roots Festival in Rotorua. But he played last year at Wellington Folk Festival, which is coming up this year again at the end of October. And he is a fascinating man because he plays very unusually, and he is he's fascinating to listen to because it's all about the story that he tells. So here we go, The Splitter's Woe. And I thought that was appropriate because we've just been talking about the felling of the bush. Here you go.
I got the splitter's woe. Got the splitter's woe. Where to go? Where to go? Where to go? Oh, passing of the rain, coming out of the sea, turning of the days in anger against me. Empty out my longing, let the air come rushing in. Man, it's simply nothing till it's gone, I'm giving in. I got the splitter of woe. Got the splitter of woe. Where go? Where go? Where go? Oh, I love you for real. Rivers just a day. This makes it easier than that's just what I say. Failed in my learning and I ever let you down. Make my ex a hammer, I refuse to put it down. I got this splitter, whoa. Got this splitter, whoa. Where to go? Where to go? Where to go? Oh, we can make a circle. Circle makes a wheel. Whole thing goes forever, that's the nature of. Have no understanding, understanding is not for me. Sun, it goes on burning, and it will, it come on to. I got the splitter, whoa. Got the splitter, whoa. Where to go? Where to go?
Thank you.
That was Adam McGrath playing, singing The Splitters' Wow. And I've just looked up, the New Zealand Blues Roots and Groove Festival is on at the Globe, Manawatu, and it's on the weekend of the first weekend of September, from the 5th to the 8th of September. And the lineup is spectacular. I really recommend it. Apart from Adam McGrath, we've got Darren Watson. We've got Karen Clark, who's absolutely wonderful. And you'll love her. And, it's really, really good. So I really recommend it if you can get along to the Blues Roots and Groove Festival. Do go along. It will be fantastic. And it's New Zealand music. And that's what, you know, if we can support New Zealand music, we should do, because it's not easy to be a musician in New Zealand, because there just isn't a big enough market to make it viable. I know, I'm married to a musician, and believe me, if we had to exist on what he earns as a musician, it would be bread and dripping rather a lot. So I want to go back to talking about the Scandinavian settlement, because I think it's really interesting. And, of course, it was all around Morrisville. So apart from the fact that the Scandinavians needed an interpreter, and an interesting fact is that a lot of them would have had some English, and they often made a big attempt to learn some English. But according to Bagnall, it was some 3 weeks after the men came out before the women and children came through, and much more expensive to get the 20 or so families from Wellington to the bush edge, because, of course, there wasn't yet a railroad. The hire of four drays for families and baggage plus meals on the road came to the staggering total of £84, 15 shillings and 6 pence, which some of the unfortunate immigrants had to repay as part of their cost of location. Some of their fellow citizens showed a commendable awareness of the profit to be made from government contracts. Has that changed much? Anyway, subdivision of the 4,000 acres which had been set aside for them was well behind schedule. The surveyor, Arthur Carkeek, received a mild rocket for his tardiness, but he was little more than a scapegoat for official lack of planning. I mean, in those days, they had to bush bash to get anywhere. It was only in the preceding October that William Gibson, then Minister of Works, had outlined to London the plan for 70-mile bush settlements, and progress on the spot had been minimal. Another 10 months were to pass before the immigrants could get onto their sections. Low morale, the rigours of the winter, into which they had been virtually flogged, and poor camp hygiene caused much sickness. It must have been miserable, because they would have been basically in shacks or tents. Supplies too were essential, for it would be some time before they could live off the harvest between the stumps. Their small wages, initially at 6 shillings per day, were the reward for hard labour in clearing, firstly, the main road line from the camp through Weston's Clearing to the site of what was to be Morrisville, a somewhat hilly resting place, as the traveller sees it today, whether arriving from north and south. An 1882 commentator said there was hardly 6 acres of really flat land in the whole block, while the settlers themselves were as likely to mutter about the swampy hollows. In Masterton on the way up, Holcombe had made a hasty arrangement with Bannister to erect a store and supply the Scandinavians at low rates. Regrettably, he agreed also that the government would allow orders in his Bannister's favour to have preference after satisfaction of good claims, which actually meant that when the Crown had taken its regular deductions from the men's slender earnings, Bannister could have the rest. Although it was later claimed that the situation had been fully explained to the men, the language difficulty compounded genuine misunderstanding in conjunction with the real temptation to newcomers of being able to purchase on credit. Some embarrassing overcommitments occurred, and Holcombe, noticing at the outset that some of the men were making purchases quite out of proportion to their means, claimed to have warned both Dreyer and Bannister. The architect builder C.J. Toxford, a fellow Dane, wrote of the men's behalf, and some refused to sign any further deduction authority. When the arrangement was investigated, it was clearly ruled illegal, the later procedure being merely to give the storekeeper due notice of payday, and they can take measures to protect themselves. Oh gosh, it was so tough, and having their fellow settlers trying to make money from them must have been so upsetting for them. Okay, so let's have another song. Let's have the Ballad of Swagger McGee, because the Swaggers, of course, took up going around. They would take off and go around and just pack with packs on their back and try and make their living as best they could. So here we go. The Ballad of Swagger McGee.
It's been a good time, but I can still recall the Swaggers turning up for the shear on our station.
I remember old man McGee.
Irish originally, I think. I remember his wonderful tales full of trolls and kelpies, piskies and tunny far. Yeah, it was pretty sad what happened to him though.
When I was a young lad, my da said to me, if I behaved badly, then Swagman McGee would come round tonight for a word in me ear. And Swagger McGee had been dead 40 years. He carried his whole world stacked high on his back, as he wandered each highway, each lowway, each track. Our county would hear no more of his gay song, the day when two lads pulled a prank that went wrong. His days on the road were hard yet simple, his nights on the road were often lonely. Yet that was his life, he'd have no other. Old Swaggin's the life for the Swagman McGee. Returned from the Great War in 1918, though he'd never tell tales of that which he'd seen. Instead, for a pint he would give you a tune of some elves in the woods or the man in the moon. To Featherston in town he'd come up for supplies, to stock up on grog or scoff down a few pies. The feed in his belly he'd leave a fair tip, then head for the river to have a wee kip. His days on the road, it made him happy, his nights on the road, it made him feel free. The road was his life, he'd have no other. Oh, Swaggin's the life for the Swagman McGee. Down by the banks of the Taranikau, he'd pull at his pipe and he'd watch the stream flow. Lean back on his pack, he'd swig his whiskey and drift off to sleep beneath the cowrie. Along came the rascals from Underhill way. Let's give the old scruff a cold bath, one would say. The other agreed, and so down the pair crept, unheard and unseen, to where McGee slept. His days on the road were often dangerous, his nights on the road were downright risky. But that was his life, he'd have no other. Old Swaggin's the life for the Swagman McGee. Then out from the bush they approached from above, with a 1, 2, 3, 4 and an almighty shove. The old boy went rolling down clean off the bank. His swag became ballast and down McGee sank. His corpse eddied up down by Madison's place, such a hideous corpse for the eels chewed his face. The townsfolk assumed 'twas some drunken mishap, but the boys from the town knew it wasn't like that. A noise in the dark, it made them anxious, a splash in the stream, a guilty memory. Their jape cost his life, he'd have no other, just haunting and taunting for Ghosty McGee. The first lad went down to the priest to confess, but the revenant haunted him more and not less. When he went missing, they searched for a week. They found the young scamp face down in a creek. The next lad had tried to escape his tormentor, who chased the lad screaming right through the town center. Just when he realized his flight was in vain, the fleer was crushed by the 5:40 train. So listen, my boy, don't play the joker, treat all with respect and dignity too. Or one of these nights, a face half-eaten with swag on its back will come hunting for you.
So that was the Ballad of Swagger McGee, and obviously he was the bogeyman that was used to make children be good. It's a bit of a scary thing to do, but there you go. The information I've been giving you to do today is from Wairarapa, an historical excursion, this book here, by A.G. Bagnall. And it was published by Headley's Bookshop Limited for the Masterton Trustlands Trust. And it's absolutely excellent book. If you are interested in the history of the Wairarapa, I recommend that you get hold of it. It is out of print, but Joseph Gillard, who lent me this copy, tells me you can occasionally, copies do come up. And in fact, I have got a local bookseller on the hunt for me so that I can have my own copy. Otherwise, I'm going to have to Joseph's going to have to arm wrestle me to get this one back. Well, it was my pleasure to be with you today. I hope you enjoyed listening to me and listening to the stories of the Wairarapa. I thought it was great to be able to come in and talk about some of the European settlement after we'd been hearing about the Maori settlement of the the Maori stories of the Wairarapa. Perfect synchronicity, and really enjoyed it. And we are hoping at Cobblestones Museum that once we've got the new building built, we will have a much bigger piece in the museum itself, explaining the history of the Wairarapa from a Maori perspective, from a Te'ao Maori perspective. And we're going to be working with Papawai Marae to be able to do that. They're going to be taking over a part of the front part of the museum, which is perfect because they will go together and it will be much more holistic. So that's it from me for this week, and I hope you'll join me again in 2 weeks' time. And meantime, stay safe out there, because the weather forecast is not great at the moment, but a lot of rain. So look after yourselves, and see you in a couple of weeks' time. Thank you for listening. Bye.